Okay. So first get acquainted and be maybe faster than we hoped. Then I'll share my overview. I was thinking 9:45 to 10, get acquainted. But it would be 5 to 10 until, say, 5 after 10, get acquainted. And then for about 40 minutes, my overview. And then leave clearly at least 25 minutes for discussion, questions and answers and so on. But I will say that I actually don't mind being interrupted. And if somebody interrupts and they got a question and it takes me off track, I'll just say, just hold that question and do it later. But if you got one that you just want to pop up with, that's all right. Now, I need to know, or I'd like to know, where you're at regarding 9/11. Isn't this amazing? This got put in there. So, what I've done, I think I'm going to begin to focus now. What I've done so often in public meetings, especially before I screen my DVD, and I got no PowerPoint or anything. It's just me in these chairs. Is to ask what I call a four-box questionnaire. And this seems to work universally. And in a way, I'm not going to predict anything. The four-box questionnaire goes like this. That there are essentially four ways you can look at 9/11. There are more ways, but I find that almost every other way can be accommodated within four. So I'm going to ask you, and I'll give you the four, and then I'll ask you to put your hands up later when I go through them. Which comes closest to your take on 9/11? Number one, the official story of the 19 crazed Muslims who caught the whole of the U.S. military, diplomatic, political, intelligence communities completely off guard on 9/11. That's choice one. Box one, the official story. Box two is the incompetence theory, that there was some information had been gathered by U.S. intelligence and so on about these coming horrid events, but that somehow there wasn't enough and people didn't act soon enough to prevent or even ameliorate them. That's the incompetence theory, box two. Box three is a little darker, and that is that there was a huge amount of information came in and that it was the events were allowed to proceed on purpose. And of course, box four is the inside job theory, that it was in fact executed by elements associated with the White House. Those are those four boxes. Are you ready to vote? Okay. How many here believe box one, the official story? And there's no shame if you do, actually. Yeah, oh, there is. Okay. But look, don't feel...
You're not dumb. I don't have time for you.
Don't feel too complacent, because the last two times I did this, in Seattle with about 900 people and in Denver with 200, not a single hand went up for box one either. And that was more or less... It wasn't the general public. Okay, how many people truly believe that incompetence essentially explained what happened? Okay, sorry. Box three then... They allowed it to happen. How many believe they allowed it to happen? Alrighty. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And then how many believe it was an inside job? So I can't count you. So now you know where you stand. So that's valuable. Now, then I'm going to skip the reasons why you're here, because there's so many and they could overlap. So we'll just knock that out. There's another thing I'm interested in. I'd like to have hands up on three categories. Number one would be people here who are employed, have an employer. Number two, people here who are self-employed. And number three is people who don't fit either category. That'd be student or retired, I guess. So are you ready? Okay, how many people here are employed by an employer? And the ones who are employed by the CIA, keep your hands up. Ah, come on, you're not doing it. Okay, how many people here are self-employed? So it's about an even split that way. And then how many people here don't fit either category, you're student or senior? Okay, that's very interesting. And I'll tell you why I asked that, and then we'll get on. In my book, Towers of Deception, the media cover-up of 9/11, part of it consists of profiles of 9/11 truth people. And there were to be 18, and now it's 15 because of last-minute technical questions. I'm sorry, Ralph Schoenman, for instance, is not among those profiled. I say in the preface of the book, there are so many worthy people who should be profiled, and for various reasons, they're not. But in the next edition, we'll rectify that. I hope there'll be a next edition. So I had, at one point, a list of about 40 people who would be candidates to be profiled. Does this work? Is there any reason for being here? No.
You're being recorded.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
For radio.
Okay, I'm sorry. I should have paid attention to that. And I was discourteous. I'm sorry. So at one point I had about 40 names of potential profilees. And I started to put columns in. Like, to qualify, you had to be authentic. There could be no question you could possibly be an agent, at least as far as I could understand, or winkle out, have made a significant contribution to the 9/11 truth, to be in it for the long run, and so forth. So then I thought, well, I have other criteria. I prefer a gender balance, so I opened a column for gender. And then I thought, I want it to be as international as possible, so I opened a column for nationality. And then for some reason, I opened a column for employment, because it's kind of interested, where do people come from who are 9/11 truth people? Well, here's what I found out. 39 of the 40 people were self-employed. When you work for somebody, you have certain mandates and responsibilities to your employer. And these could be in conflict with 9/11 truth. So would anybody like to throw, you people who are employed, would a couple of you offer any thoughts about whether there's a contradiction or a conflict or if you've had a price to pay? Please.
Sure. I'm a Unitarian minister in Austin, Texas, and have written sermons on living under fascism and a book on American fascism and God. And when I talked about the 9/11 theory, and I do think that it was allowed and made to happen on purpose, the 550 people there, about 100 of them gave a standing ovation, and three or four walked out, and the paper reported it as the pastor taking a 9/11 stance that split the church. And that's still boiling after 3 months. So there is pressure, even in a Unitarian church, to find some way to forbid discussion of the belief that this was an inside job, although it's pretty hard for Unitarians to do. They can't figure out how they're going to draw that line, but the pressure is quite strong.
That's very interesting. I'm a former Unitarian. Yes?
The gentleman said this morning told me that after 9/11, he started being kind of vocal, and then his pastor said it was causing waves within the church, so he didn't need to be so vocal anymore because George Bush is a Christian man.
Yeah, well, there was that big conference. There was a major conference, I think, in Washington, D.C. very recently, about 4 days, about spirituality and the left.
Conservative cultural leadership.
Yeah. Did you want to make a comment?
Well, I worked for a two-year college in Wisconsin.
Can't hear you.
See, I work for a two-year college in Wisconsin. I don't make my views. I don't hide my views. I've had no problem in terms of our school administration. However, when it comes to working with the public, which I do, there is occasional conflict based on my views. Sometimes on my chest.
Well, that's... I thank you for that feedback. It'd be interesting to explore it further. We'll let it go at that, and it may come back somehow to that. For my overview, then, which we're actually starting on time according to the new schedule, is there a seat? Are there any seats left over there at all? Okay, please go ahead and.
Thank you.
Yeah. And hold up your hand for any more seats left for these people. There's three seats. I'd like to share an historical overview. I'd like to share then our present situation and prospects for the future. And thirdly, how we're wired to cope with this situation. Now, the historical overview, I would begin by suggesting what an amazing privilege it is for us to be alive at this time in the history of our planet. But I must say that when I say we, I unfortunately am referring primarily to white middle class North Americans and Europeans, primarily. I don't want to do that, but that has to come with the territory. Now, if we were meeting even just, say, 150 years ago with our horses tethered outside, just think how relatively powerless we would be. We wouldn't have the power to get in touch instantly with other individuals and information and ideas from around the planet. We would not have access to most of the knowledge accumulated by our species, a knowledge base which is growing exponentially. We have more knowledge power, each of us in this room, than any king in history ever dreamed of having. And this is an immense privilege, and with it is a great responsibility. We are privileged, but we're in danger, because we must quickly increase our grasp of history. Alex Jones, and to some extent Maria Heller last evening, and especially Ralph Schoenman, in an interview, a video interview that I was able to sit in on and participate with, have spelled out brilliantly the essential characteristics of the human journey and the way that human beings, certain human beings, seek power. I'm going to go into that more. We have to, in a word, learn more faster than ever before. In order to have a chance of saving ourselves. I think I began saying around 1970, when I had my first university classes, that I doubted then that enough people could learn enough, fast enough, to take enough actions that would then result in outcomes that would help us save ourselves from a global crash. 1970, I started to say that. And it has never become better in the interim. However, another thing we have to be grateful for is that we are, in fact, in a multidimensional crisis. The worst one by far, of course, being the planetary ecological crisis. We are destroying our Earth, as you know. I don't need to spell that out for this group. And so crisis is probably the best teacher there is. I remember years ago meeting a futurist and sociologist named Richard Farson. In California. He was married to Jennifer Jones, the Hollywood actress, and they were very gracious, and I was interviewing them for a research project for the Ontario Arts Council, and Richard said, people think that they learn from their mistakes. And he said, that's almost never true. But other people say, well, we learn from our successes. And he said, there's quite a bit of truth to that. But he said, when we learn the most, by far, is in crisis. You find out your marriage is breaking up, you've got a terminal illness, you're going bankrupt. That is when both your ideas and your behavior are plastic. They will change. So that crisis, and the Chinese have the word for crisis, which includes the concept of opportunity, crisis is working for us now. And as it deepens, it works for us more powerfully. Now, in past speaking engagements, because I got onto history, and I recommend books, especially A Short History of Progress. I don't have the book here because I couldn't find it when I left Toronto. A Short History of Progress by Ronald Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T. It's a thin book. It doesn't cost much. It's economical. It's the best book I've seen in a long time about the history of Homo sapiens sapiens. Ronald Wright points out that early societies, he follows the collapse of civilizations the same way as Jared Israel does in his book Collapse. But with Wright, it's so compact and beautifully stated. It was actually a series of 5 one-hour lectures. That's all it is. And he said that early on, and I'll blend this now with what he says and what I've conflated with it. That certain people have an impulse to leadership or to power. I can see it with our granddaughter, 2.5, in the play area. You know, there's a kid who will go around bullying, and usually the other kids have trouble coping with it. And of course, at that age, they don't know enough to get together in solidarity and deal with the bully. And so already, from a young age, there are people who have an impulse to power. Now, a fraction of those, which is, I believe, around 2%, if there are any psychologists in the crowd, anyway, are psychopaths. Psychopaths just have, their wiring is wrong, and they don't have any empathy or compassion, and they have to learn about it by mimicking other people. So Bonnie Faulkner sees some sad thing, and Bonnie starts to get very sad and rub her eyes. And the psychopaths, oh, that's what you do when you're supposed to be sad. So they become extremely charming in their above-average intelligence. There recently was a large article in one of the Toronto newspapers about psychopaths in business. It was in the Globe and Mail. And they are the ones that reach the top. Kenny Lay. He's a psychopath, I would say. I'm not in a position to clinically diagnose him, but apparently he really screwed himself on the witness stand because he still had no kind of humility or anything. So in business, we can see that. Well, fortunately, I was thinking this, reading this whole article, it covered a whole page. I was thinking, come on, how about the political leaders? And sure enough, there were two letters came in the next day saying, what about the political leaders and their psychopathy? So it appears that there are people who are born without, I won't want to say conscience, because conscience, you know, they say conscience be your guide, very poor guide. Like if you were raised in a society that condoned infanticide, well then your conscience would lead you, yeah, kill this infant. You'd have a clear conscience. Conscience is a malleable thing. It's dependent upon the culture within which it's embedded. So conscience is a very slippery concept. But let us say that there are those who don't have empathy. That's more accurate, sort of clinically speaking. And have this impulse to power, and are above average intelligence. So, what tricks do they use? They've got nothing against tricks. Well, deception just comes up right away, they begin. We all deceive. University of Massachusetts study recently found, on average, people tell a lie every 10 minutes. And I've only had a chance to tell two so far. But I'm not average. But we'll come more to this later. But anyway, deception comes naturally to them to get their way. And then bullying does. Coercion of various kinds. Threats. Then bribing. Seducing. Flattering. And of course, as they get older, they're willing to use physical force and threats of physical force and up to killing. And then they have to do some robbing, too, because they need funds to keep their project going. And like the IRA that robbed banks to get its money. Of course, most of them were actually British agents, but we'll come to that later. So anyway, this is a skill set that the psychopath uses on his path to power. So when he gets there, what skill set is he going to continue to use to maintain and expand his power? The very same skill set. Lying, cheating, deception, coercion, bullying, bribing. The whole skill set. And Alex Jones sums it up. He says, they're the scum of the earth. I don't like name calling. So I don't know what they are of the earth. But they're a scourge, at least. So this has happened all through history. So we continually allow ourselves to come under the thrall of these self-appointed psychopaths. It may not be that extreme, but I do have a friend, a clinical psychologist for 22 years, and he says the closer you get to the top of any organization, the more likely you are to encounter a psychopath. Now, back to history. I started to bore audiences because I went into history so much. Finally, somebody in one audience just said, "You're boring us!" So that was a 30-minute talk, so I cut my history down to 10 minutes. And then I found I was in a position I had to do it in five. And so what happened was that I got it down to 75 seconds. So here's my 75-second world history. Early societies, cooperative, based on caring and sharing. Religions get established, very problematical. Technology develops. Many advances turn out to be progress traps. Example, irrigation ruins land through salinization. Priests become kings. Kings learn best way to mobilize and control people is through war. Kings learn to make sure there's always an enemy. And if your enemy won't oblige, surest pretext for wars is a false flag operation. Warrior class becomes self-perpetuating. Kings subjugate and steal from their own. Life is struggle, struggle, struggle. Societies move to stabbing and grabbing. Nature becomes neglected, then abused. Civilization after civilization breaks down through environmental collapse. New civilizations, more complex, wealthiest at top, form anti-democratic oligarchies. Continues as ruling system today. System also neglects and abuses nature on a larger scale. Oligarchies expand their power. Members enjoy immense unearned riches long after environmental degradation sets in and people begin suffering. Concentration of power and wealth now grotesque. Members of oligarchy, clearly dinosaurs. Most visible one, Bushosaurus Rex. Whole system becomes House of Cards, otherwise known as today's world. Planet dying. Top TV show, American Idol. Now, the second thing I want to deal with, so much for history, is our present situation and prospects for the future. And by future, I mean the fairly rapidly approaching, fairly immediate future, say the next 2, 3, 5, 10 years at most. And what I'm going to do is lean on very much here James Howard Kunstler. You may know, you may be familiar with his work, How Many People Are, James Bass, yes. And how many people here, by the way, saw The End of Suburbia? Oh, good. Oh, that's good. So, by the way, you might be interested to know that Beyond Suburbia is a sequel that's coming up, and it'll be higher production values. Not that the production values were too bad in End of Suburbia. Now, James Howard Kunstler wrote a terrific article called The Long Emergency, and if I can just quote him, he says, most immediately we face the end of the cheap fossil fuel era. And it's no exaggeration to state that reliable supplies of cheap oil and natural gas underlie everything we identify as the necessities of modern life, not to mention all of its comforts and luxuries, central heating, air conditioning, cars, airplanes, electric lights, inexpensive clothing, recorded music, movies, hip replacement, surgery, national defense, you name it. The peak of oil, I believe peak oil has arrived myself, is when half of the available known supplies of oil have been used up. Now you'd think, well, that's pretty good because it's been about 100 years since oil was discovered, so maybe get another 100 years. Not so. Unfortunately, the second half of the oil supply is much harder to reach and much more important, much more expensive to extract, and in fact, a lot of it isn't going to be extracted. And I speak as a Canadian in a state of deep, deep shame about the so-called Alberta tar sands. It's actually bitumen, and there are vehicles there that are larger than this room, and they are spending billions of dollars to deface northern Alberta, and in doing so, they have to use such huge amounts of natural gas in order to melt this stuff down, natural gas that by the billions of cubic feet that should be going or being saved for other purposes, and they need so much water that the Athabasca River, a beautiful river that my brother and his wife and friends have canoed every spring for many years, has dropped a whole foot already, and they're not even getting into the tar sands to the extent that they plan to. Dick Cheney went up and visited the place to personally look it over. I don't know whether he did any hunting while he was up there. He just hunting for resources. If you count the energy inputs required to get the tar sands bitumen into some usable petroleum, The energy inputs, this part from environmental degradation, the energy inputs are so great that those reserves that Cheney and everybody else talked about have to be reduced by 40%. Because you're using that much energy that the end product will give you back.